It's the Burt Cohen Show. The dream goes on. America, government of, by, and for the people. And there's been a lot of noise lately, a lot of concern about socialism. Concern especially on the right. But, you know, what is socialism anyway? What are people so afraid of? And our guest today is going to talk about some socialism that does exist, that has existed. It's certainly not new to President Obama, that's for sure. Some power that it's not so much government of, by, and for we the people. Government of, by, and for, well, perhaps he can describe it. Les Leopold is our guest today. Thanks for being with us, Les, on the Burt Cohen Show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Les is the executive director of the Labor Institute and Public Health Institute in New York, author of The Looting of America, How Wall Street's Game of Fantasy Finance Destroyed Our Jobs, Pensions, and Prosperity, and What We Can Do About It. And that's put out by Chelsea Green, 2009. And our guest, Les Leopold, is working on a new book, How to Earn $900,000 an Hour, The Rise of Wall Street Billionaires and the One-Sided Class War. Well, you have an article out now that's called, let me see if I can find it here, Financial Socialism by and for Wall Street Elites. Well, what kind of socialism is that, and how long has it been existing? So how would you define the socialism that exists for the Wall Street elites?
Well, they have themselves in a very unique position in our economy where they can gamble and win and keep these enormous profits, and they can gamble and lose and have the taxpayer, they can basically socialize the losses. And this has been, it's been going on, it's been building up for the last 30 years, but we saw its fruition during the financial crisis. And one of the best ways to see this is to juxtapose it to what real capitalism looks like. What real capitalism is supposed to look like is the following. You're an entrepreneur. You take risks. If your investments and your production or your sales of what you're working on take off, you get the benefit of those risks. If you don't succeed, however, the market basically washes you away. There was a great economist called Joseph Schumpeter, who was a fierce critic of socialism, and he called this capitalist effort creative destruction. And what he was basically saying is that, yes, there's a lot of destruction in capitalism, but the creative part is you get a lot of innovation because those that take the risks and succeed have to be the innovators, while the others fall by the wayside. But what's going on in the financial sector is a group of companies and financial elites have gotten basically a stranglehold on the economy. They got so large, they got so powerful, that when they took risks and failed, we bailed them out. And they know this. They knew this as it was happening. They know it even more so now. They've been designated as, you know, basically 19 of them have a title of institutionally, you know, too important to fail. And they play in a different universe. The failures are not punished by the market, but the stranglehold, the money that gets siphoned into the financial sector continues. I'll give you one clear-cut example that so galled me when it was happening. I just can't believe it went through, but it shows you how strong financial socialism is. In about a year and a half ago, almost 2 years ago, when AIG was collapsing, the giant insurance company, and it had put out insurance on various toxic assets, and those assets were $13 billion worth of this. This insurance was taken out by Goldman Sachs, and it was sort of covering their toxic assets. And that was a private sector transaction, right? Goldman Sachs took a risk on these toxic assets and tried to balance their risk by buying insurance from AIG. Now, that was entirely a private sector transaction. AIG, it turns out, put out too much insurance, couldn't cover all its bets, and was about to go under. And it was rescued to the tune of something like $170 billion of taxpayer money went in there to keep AIG from collapsing.
Right, my money and yours.
Yep. Now, under the rules of capitalism, Goldman Sachs should have taken what is called a haircut. They deserved, basically, they took a gamble under the free market system, and they lost. And they should have taken a severe cut, maybe pennies on the dollar, at most,
sure,
5-10 cents on a dollar of that $13 billion. Instead, they were given 100 cents on the dollar. Their bet was entirely covered by the U.S. taxpayer. Now, if that isn't that, well, let's put it this way. That's my definition of financial socialism. A big financial company took a gamble, lost, and then we bailed them out, not just partially, but entirely. And nobody else in the real economy gets treated that way. So when we bailed out GM, the auto workers took cuts in their wages and benefits. Even the bondholders took a haircut,
mm-hmm.
But not in the financial sector. In that sector, you get rewarded entirely. So they're in another universe. It's not a utopian socialism. It's a entirely dysfunctional socialism, but it works very, very well. One of the questions. Don't let me just prattle on here.
Keep going. Very interesting.
Well, the question that comes to mind that is not really being fully addressed and discussed, and that's why I'm trying to do another book on it, is why do they get paid so much more than everybody else? Obviously, one reason is because of this financial socialism. They've got a stranglehold on the economy, and they're getting profits that are not really from creating new value. But ask yourself, I mean, just think about this for a second. There's a 35-year-old or 40-year-old trader working in a bank or in a hedge fund, and he's making maybe 100 or 1,000 times more than the top-paid neurosurgeons in this country. How can that be? What is the justification for that? Well, again, the Schumpeters of the world will tell you, well, you get what you earn in relationship to the economic value you produce for the economy. But there is no model that, and no one is suggesting that these bond traders or these hedge fund manipulators are producing real value for the economy. They're certainly not producing. Here's one statistic that just blows me away. Here's two statistics that I think listeners will really get a kick out of. The top 25 hedge fund managers in 2009, which was arguably the worst year since the Great Depression financially, they pulled in as much money for themselves in 1 year as it cost to pay 658,000 entry-level teachers.
So that
25 hedge fund gurus. The top 10 averaged $900,000 an hour. The top number one earned in 1 minute as much as an entry-level teacher.
For a year.
1 minute. Now, how have to come to terms with this as a country. This is not something you can just say, well, He's got a good voice, and he hits the baseball a long way. He's a great quarterback, and that's why he gets so much.
Right.
As a matter of fact, when I write these articles, people say, well, you know, we pay entertainers way too much anyway, so now we're just paying hedge fund people way too much. But we're paying the hedge fund people in 1 month what Alex Rodriguez, the star Yankee baseball
yes.
player, gets paid in 10 years.
In 1 month versus A-Rod's 10
In other words, the highest
years.
Baseball player contract is $250 million. That's over 10 years.
Not
That's
bad.
What these top hedge fund people, the top 10, get in 1 month. There's a whole nother universe that they're in. It's not like entertainment. It's like financial socialism. It's ripping off the real economy. The wealth that all of us are producing through all the hard work that takes place in this economy,
right.
a piece of it, a little vigorish, is going into the top hedge fund Wall Street pockets. And we have to put a stop to that. We can't just tax the money away. We've got to get it away before it gets into their pockets because they start thinking it's theirs.
Uh-huh.
This is all part of, this was, and this led, in fact, to the crash that, I talk about in the looting of America. By the way, I want to tell your listeners that what's sure. happening now in the country as a whole is people are starting to forget what caused the crisis. We're starting to say, we have too much debt and this and that and the other. But all of the problems we're facing right now economically come from a crash that took place on Wall Street, entirely on Wall Street, caused by Wall Street, and then basically pushed off onto the rest of us, causing a crash that the rest of us are suffering from.
I was going to say, Americans, look, we all have very, very short memories. And what we're talking about here, the financial socialism for one sector of the economy, it's a little bit hard to see, a little bit hard to get. You can see, the baseball players, the money they get, the entertainers, we love them. They get more money. Okay, they're producing something for us. But these guys, there's a long history of struggle in the United States in the economy between classes, about the producer class. That was kind of the term that was used in the 1890s, back in that gilded age when there was a huge, huge discrepancy between the wealth at the top and everybody else. And, a lot of the laboring people, the working people, were called the producers, and other people really didn't produce anything here. We are talking to Les Leopold about the idea of socialism for the financial sector. And you say they're the only class that gets treated like that. Well, I have to ask about the nuclear power industry. Now, the rest of us, we play by the rules. As you said right in the beginning of the Bert Cohen show here, that, if you produce something, people like it, you get paid well. If you don't, if you make something that doesn't work, if it breaks or something, oops, people don't buy it anymore. Well, nuclear power, which Barack Obama is still in support of, I would argue is part of the socialist class as well, because if it weren't for you and I, taxpayers, providing insurance for the nuclear industry ourselves, if the nuclear industry, had to go out on the open market and get their own insurance, guess what? There would be no nuclear power because they could never get insured. Nobody would insure them for that kind of stuff. That class of people, that tiny segment of our economy, is supported by we the people. And I don't think, I think that's what the Tea Party people are so angry about. They see a government supporting some interests at the expense of everybody else. Has the Tea Party, Les, gotten a hold of this issue? They talk a lot about socialism. They don't like socialism. We like a republic. We like a democracy. What has the Tea Party had to say about the socialism for the financial industry on Wall Street?
Well, it's interesting. It's an interesting. They have themselves a problem because they say they are furious about the bailouts that went to Wall Street. But in fact, they're even more furious about the government. So they are willing to have the government pull back from regulating Wall Street because they're so angry at the government, they don't want it squashing what they would call, the private economy.
Right.
So they still, I think, to their detriment, still think that somehow Wall Street is part of the private economy. And so they have a dilemma. They hate what's going on in Wall Street, but they have no way, no program, no plan, no idea, no clue of how to rein it in. I would like to make just one more distinction here.
Sure.
Which is, while I agree with you entirely on nuclear power, and you know, there's a long history of how we got stuck with it, and it goes all the way back to Adams for Peace and our desire to kind of sell to the world the idea that nuclear weapons, in a sense, are that we had and used, that this was like the positive side, and the genie's out of the bottle, and it's hard to get it back in. But what's going on Wall Street, I want to argue, is categorically different than anywhere else in society. There's the amount of money that's being hauled off there is so astronomically more than anywhere else that I want us to not broaden our focus too much. I want us to really come down hard on what's going on there, because my argument is this: I don't think we can solve any of our other problems economically until we rein in Wall Street. We learned this during the Great Depression. What's not being talked about enough is what we did to financial speculation during the 1930s and beyond. We squashed it. We sat on it. We made finance a boring industry all the way from the mid-1930s until about 1980. There were some very smart people that were in finance, but their incomes were not that different from people in other areas of the economy, based on their seniority and their education and their skill, however you want to measure it. But then we sort of forgot the lessons in the 1930s, and we started deregulating, and the myth of free markets coming to Wall Street, self-regulating free markets took over,
right.
and it just blew up again. It's going to blow up again because we haven't fundamentally changed it. And so I want to keep my eye on the prize. I think nuclear power is going to collapse on its own weight, because I don't think they're ever going to find a place to deal with the
waste.
And there's a proliferation problem. Obama can't have it both ways. He can't say he's trying to stop nuclear proliferation and then try to proliferate nuclear reactors that can be dual purpose. Once you're learning one technology, you can expand to the other technologies that are far more dangerous. You get dirty bombs. You don't even need to have a full-fledged bomb. There's a lot of problems there. In fact, there are problems. There are three sectors of the economy where free markets don't work very well. Obviously, in the defense industry is one. The other is in healthcare, and the third is in finance. And my argument, I've gotten more radical over the last couple of years, because I'm starting to say that if we really care about a free market economy, if you really want to have one in most areas, then I don't think you can have one in finance. I think finance has to become a publicly regulated utility like water. Matter of fact, water is a good example, because we all need it. It flows through us all. Finance, everybody needs that too. I mean, money and credit flows throughout the economy. But once it gets polluted, it's no good. Once there's toxic assets in your finance, it's like having pollutants in your water. And having a tightly regulated utility, that's what we want out of finance. We don't need high-stakes casinos, because they are going to fail again. And when they do, we're going to be faced with the same choice we were faced with last time. Either resurrect them or let the whole economy collapse and have twice as many people unemployed and suffering. That was the choice that we faced. And we haven't changed the fundamental structure that would get us out of that, very, very bad choice that's going to be put upon us. I can't tell you. I mean, I was asked in an interview just the other day, when's it going to happen again? I have no idea. But that it will happen again, I'm dead certain. I don't think anybody can predict when. But they are free again to gamble. And there's huge sums that are being moved around again, and huge leverage is taking place, and the rules are being bent, and the people. And also, think about this in terms of democracy. If you are a regulator and you're making, I don't know, maybe if you're a top government employee, $150,000 a year, maybe.
Sure.
And the person you're regulating is making the person across the table that you may be talking to is making $2-3 million, and maybe the person above him is making $5-10 million, you've got to be wondering, what the hell am I doing on this side of the table? How long is it going to take me to get from my side of the table making $100,000 to the other side where I'm making $2-5 million?
Right.
Matter of fact, Peter Orszag.
I was just thinking of him.
Yeah. And Obama didn't say boo. I was so disappointed. I mean,
well, who's putting
Peter Orszag,
right, OMB,
Office of Management and Budget,
right,
that in a sense oversees the entire federal budget, was definitely deeply involved in the bailout process, a bailout that included a huge one, hundreds of billions of dollars in guarantees and cash for Citigroup. Here's a guy, after only 2 years of service as the director, leaves and is taking a reportedly $2-3 million job at Citigroup. Now, how can you do that? How is that permissible? Well, the problem is not just the revolving door. The problem is the salaries are way too high on Wall Street. He's not going to be producing $2-3 million worth of value. He's going to be basically sucking off the value that's being siphoned off of the rest of the economy. And that mechanism of how it's being siphoned off, I want to be able to write about and explain to the American people, because we have to get to the point where we can say why these incomes are illegitimate, because that would then put us in a position to reclaim them for our economy.
Well,
we have to do.
Certainly, I think it's fair to say that people do not generally have that impression, that belief that the money that they're making is illegitimate. It seems to me that the way most Americans see it is, look, you know, we're all capitalists here. Well, virtually everybody that feels like, hey, if you're making money, good for you. And the argument is, if somebody's making money, that's where the jobs are generated. The old trickle down thing. But what exactly, you know, it's about producing things. Like, for example, Apple produces something called the iPad. They produce the iPhone, the iThis, the it's real things. People love them. They buy them. People get rich over there. McDonald's Corporation, they were a very, very efficient business, made what, well, people felt was a good product, provides a service. People pay for it, and they make a lot of money. Nothing wrong with that. But what are these guys, the hedge fund people, the private equity people, how are they making their money? And you say it's being siphoned off. I don't think there's
right.
a very wide perception.
Explain. They're legitimate and what I would call illegitimate functions. The legitimate function is money does have to go from where it's being saved to where it can be invested, either spent, either by consumers or by businesses. So you need money for your mortgage to buy a home. And the process of taking savings, turning into a mortgage, checking you out, going through the paperwork, there's value to doing that. And they call it financial intermediation. And there's also value of making sure that there's a whole range of products with different time spans on them and risks that people can invest in, because that keeps the money flowing.
Right.
No problem there. I can handle those functions, and there's certainly value to them, and they should be paid, you know, commensurate to what people in the private sector would be, I mean, in other areas of the private sector would be paid to do those kind of functions, the service. It's valuable, but it's not like astronomically valuable.
Right.
Then there's this. When there's slight variation of prices within markets, and if you have the super high-speed computers, you and you have a huge amount of money that you can leverage, you can go in and out of those markets in a millisecond and maybe move, you know, $10 or $15 million in and out, and you make a tiny fraction of a cent off of that transaction. But because you've leveraged up, you've made $10 or $15 million for your company. Now, where's that money come from? Well, my guess is it comes from our pension funds, mutual funds, other operations that don't move that fast. In other words, every day your pension fund goes into the market and buys something and sells something, redeems, you know, tries to keep a balanced portfolio. the normal things that a pension does. But it's not getting the best price it possibly can get, because the second before it makes a big trade, the computers at some of these proprietary trading desks pick up the action and beat you to it, buy it and sell it at a slightly higher price. So you're paying a fraction higher than you should have been paying, and they made the difference, and you didn't even see it happen. That to me is an illegitimate function. All it does is transfer wealth from the pension fund to the hedge fund. Nothing new was created. They say we brought liquidity to the market. There's plenty of liquidity in the market for these kinds of things that are buying and selling. So one way to stop that from happening is to put a small but significant transaction tax on each and every financial transaction, called the Tobin tax, in honor of James Tobin, who was Nobel laureate many years ago, who wanted to do something like this. He called it putting sands in the gears of speculation. So that when you make these high-speed trades, the transaction cost is high enough that you don't do it, or you don't do it as often, because you're not going to make $10 million. You're going to end up making $2 million, and the rest is going to go to the transaction tax. What that does is not only does it slow down speculation, but it creates a pot of money that can go back into the real economy and actually create jobs. Because I think what's happening now is it's one thing to say that, you know, wealthy people get wealthy because they're smart and et cetera, and it makes us all better off. But what if it doesn't make us all better off? What if, in fact, it makes us worse off because it's connected to the jobs crisis that we're now involved in? And matter of fact, it's doubly connected, because not only did they cause the crisis to begin with, but now there's so much debt because we bailed them out, we don't have enough money to put people back to work. So we're going through this deficit reduction, deficit dance right now. We're going to be laying off, hundreds of thousands of public sector workers all over the country, which is only going to make the problem worse. And we could have stopped that from happening. This financial transaction tax could have easily bailed out all the state. I mean, why shouldn't you bail out state and local governments? It's not their fault that the revenues collapsed because there was a jobs crisis and a business crisis caused by Wall Street. Why not have Wall Street pay restitution to clean up the mess they created? I mean, what I don't understand is we're not even having this discussion anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That's what kind of blows my mind. It's a kind of scary thing. When the crash happened, I knew I had a moment to try to talk about this stuff. So, I was working on financial, believe it or not, I was actually working on trying to explain toxic assets. And then the crash hit, and I quickly put Looting of America together because I knew people needed some basic understanding of what was going on. And I knew that the system was collapsing, and I knew you could talk about the system as a whole. But what's going on now is it's like the organism is now protecting itself. Wall Street made it through. They were under the gun, but they put so much heat on the political process that they now have made it through, and it's now becoming illegitimate to talk about the big picture. It's now, you got to be real. You got to talk about the real economy. I mean, we have a fiscal, taxes are too high on a local level, or we can't afford, the pensions of public sector workers. We got to talk at that level. What you're talking about is pie in the sky, because the kind of stuff that happened in the 1930s isn't happening now. You're not getting a progressive upsurge to tackle Wall Street. You're basically getting an upsurge from the right that's protecting Wall Street. My guess is in another year you won't be calling me, because you're going to say, stuff's kind of passé. But I'm telling you, it's not passé, because we haven't fixed the fundamental cancers that are going to eat up this economy. It's going to come back again. I'm sorry to say that President Obama didn't come close to addressing what's going on.
No.
He never talked about it.
No.
He's afraid to talk about it because he got slapped around when he tried. He tried half-heartedly, so now he's bringing the Wall Street people into his administration.
He certainly is. It's been shocking. I mean, one of the earliest things that happened with Barack Obama when he became president was loading his desk with Wall Street insiders. It was the same old Wall Street people who sat around the desk where economic policy was discussed. We're talking on the Burt Cohen Show with Les Leopold, author of The Looting of America, and working on another book about how to earn $900,000 an hour. Now, the tax that you talked about and throwing sand on the machine of it, that sounds sort of radical and sounds sort of anti-capitalist, sounds very anti-capitalist. And I can just imagine, you know, the Tea Party people and, you know, non-Tea Party people, people who believe in the free market system and in capitalism, the idea of you know, crunching up the machine like that and stopping it down, it sounds like it would wreck the economy. Please explain how it wouldn't do that and, in fact, might actually help the economy and help the free market and create jobs.
Me?
If you can.
There's.
You proposed it.
Yeah, well, you know.
The Tobin tax, I guess you called it.
Yeah, I don't see any reason why what we call the real economy of goods and services would even notice that the Tobin tax existed. In other words, I don't see how it would have a negative impact on the real economy. Depending on how that income was used, it could have an incredibly positive impact. So, for example, Obama was, you know, trying to talk about education and innovation and stuff like that, but he wouldn't go near the most positive example we have of that, which was after World War II, we set up the GI Bill of Rights.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of worry that there would be a letdown after World War II and we'd return to the Great Depression. And what are you going to do with 8 million returning veterans? Well, 3 million of them ended up going to school. Tuition was free. And you got a stipend. If you had a family, you got a nice
sure.
stipend. You could actually kind of live on it and go to school.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out that this version of free higher education returned about $7 to the economy for every dollar invested in these people. It was the birth of the post World War II middle class. Okay, now right now we have somewhere between 25 and 29 million people who don't have full time jobs
right.
but who want them or who have dropped out of the workforce. It will take 22 million new jobs to bring us back to 5% unemployment. 22 million. Where are they going to come from? My number one candidate is to institute instantly free higher education at all public colleges and universities, 2 years, 4 years, vocational, anything that's public, complete free tuition. That would take an enormous burden off of families all over the country. It would make it would increase their disposable income dramatically, right, because they're not paying for their kids. Kids wouldn't be burdened by these enormous loans. After they graduate,
mm-hmm.
they have more disposable income. And we would probably double the number of people that went to school, which would increase the number of not just professors, but you know, universities and colleges are incredibly labor-intensive. You know, you need from secretaries to buildings and grounds, you know, all kinds of maintenance people. You just need a lot of people to run a good college, good university. And it would be an enormous pump priming activity, and that could easily be paid for by the Tobin tax. It would cost about $50 billion right now to eliminate tuition. Figure maybe $100 billion after you double it. Now, this is not like out of the Soviet Union. This is something we did in the United States of America after World War II. We found the money and we did it. And it was enormously successful. It would be such a shot in the arm right now. And you know what? Even Wall Street would profit from it because you'd have a more vibrant economy. But every aspect of the economy would be uplifted. And, of course, you would get people, hopefully, who would have more skills and more ability to contribute when they graduated. You would have this idea of winning this race that Obama thinks that we're
winning the future.
Have to win.
Right.
How do you do that? You do that when you tremendously invest in education. We've done it. We had the free university, City College was free in New York for many, many years, and it produced an incredible number of very important thinkers in all aspects of life because these were people who didn't have the money to go. That's a simple, my guess is that's at least 2, 3, 4 million people that would be removed from the unemployment rolls by doing that. And you could do it overnight.
Again, the Tea Party people, thank you very much, Fox News, for creating them so effectively. Say that, you know, if the stimulus has failed, that the stimulus is socialism. When you interrupt the free market and have the government get involved in trying to itself stimulate the economy, that's socialism, and that's not the free market, and they don't want it.
I really don't care. I really don't care. We just went through a 30-year experiment in deregulated free markets. That's exactly what happened. We deregulated virtually every aspect of the economy starting in around the late 1970s. So we had a real-time experiment of deregulated, keep government out of markets all the way from finance to, you know, telephone.
Right.
And what we did
airlines.
Was, yeah. You know, it worked pretty well in most of the economy, but it actually crashed. The whole thing went down in flames because you cannot have a deregulated financial sector. So if they want to argue about the rest of the economy, fine. But if they want to say that finance should be deregulated, it's just religion. It's not based on reality. It's just something, you know, it's anger clouding their eyes. You cannot have a deregulated Wall Street. You can't do it. You'll have 20% unemployment next time around or 30%. It's going to be a disaster. Those guys will rob us blind and crash the system.
And they don't care.
It's not their job to care.
That's true.
All they care about is making money. And if, you know, if they're making $1 million, they want to make $2 million. If they're making 10, they want to make 100. And if they're making 100, they want to run a hedge fund where they're making several billion. Look, that's what they do. They're not policymakers. They're not designed to take care of the country. That's not their job. Their job is to move money around. Our job is to keep them from tearing down the whole economy. I don't want to point at the Tea Party. I want to point at progressives. The challenge I have for progressives is that, what's our program? What are we for?
Yes.
How are we going to put, you know, 25 million people to work? What is our program? Do we also believe that the free market's going to do it all on its own? Are we going to be willing to lay out a program that we believe in that will put people back to work? I mean, the progressives are very, very quiet. I can't see the life of me. If you lock me in a closet and say, okay, I won't let you out until you tell me what progressives stand for. I'd be in that closet. I couldn't get out. I'm waiting. And, you know, and I've been banging away on this in Huffington Post and Alternet, and every place I can. I've been trying to challenge progressives, and I'm hoping that some of the bigwigs would actually get together, you know, the heads of Huffington Post and Alternet and elsewhere, and say, okay, it's time for us to, you know, get, you know, 100, 200 people together in a room and try to create a program that we think we could sell to the American people. We have to begin that process. We need to have a dialogue. The last 2 years were the best opportunity progressives ever are going to have to make a case, and we didn't do it.
No.
So it's not just the Tea Party.
No, you're right. There's, in fact, a lot of, well, not a lot, a few alleged Democrats who are...
there's some.
Yeah, but there's some who are talking about no labels. They want to have even less identity. They want to be completely indistinguishable from the right. They're so afraid of having any kind of identity. It's just that is a significant part of the problem. And I have no sympathy whatsoever with that kind of direction. We need to say who the heck we are. People know.
We need another dozen Bernie Sanders. Then I think we'd get a program.
We would. Well, that brings us to the questions, sort of two questions. A, when we had an identity in the 1930s and the 40s, we had FDR, extremely popular. It seems to me if we had a real full-fledged stimulus and actually did create jobs and actually did have public works programs, people would be thrilled. People would be very happy. They wouldn't be talking about, you know, the failed stimulus, etc. They'd be really happy. What happened in the 30s with regard to the Wall Street raiders? What did the government actually do? And I guess a follow-up question to that is, where are the Democrats in Washington? Are they completely cowed by these guys? Are they totally in the pocket of Wall Street? So, two-part question. What happened in the 30s that worked? And why the heck aren't they doing it now?
I think the place to start looking at what happened in the 30s is to look 30 years earlier, what was going on in the progressive movement. At the turn of the century, as you pointed out when we started the conversation about, you know, that was the Gilded Age and there was, you know, lots of power in the hands of a few, although the people who had a lot of power actually were still producing things that everybody could understand.
Railroads.
There were these trusts and there was trust busting. But what happened was virtually every single kind of progressive, whether they worked in a settlement house in Chicago or they were doing muckraking around meatpacking or whatever they were doing, they also were thinking about the broader economy. How should this economy be organized? And in that cauldron, there were zillions of different tendencies, but the idea of legalizing unions, wage and hour laws, Social Security, broader health insurance, child labor laws, all those kinds of things grew up. There was also ideas about a more planned economy, and that led to the TVA. Anyway, when the crash occurred, a lot of this stuff, you know, it was just bubbling up, but you couldn't be a progressive without having some kind of point of view. You might have been a socialist, later on a communist, you might have been a cooperatist, you might have been someone who just believed in more regulated capitalism. Whatever it was, you had a point of view. When the 30s hit, the crash hit, you had a complete cupboard full of ideas that Roosevelt and his advisors could pick from.
Right.
They kind of cobbled together a series of programs that people had already been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And needless to say, cracking down on Wall Street was, in a way, the easiest part. They just sat on it. They said, you're not doing this stuff anymore.
How did they do that?
You can't do these phony buying all this on margin. They just controlled. They set up Glass-Steagall. They set up where they separated investment banking, commercial banking, and they had very strict laws through the Securities and Exchange Commission. That part was actually easy. And the public works program, some didn't work. Some efforts to control markets were thrown out by the Supreme Court and weren't working anyway. And some, like the TVA, were marvelous successes. Rural electrification, all kinds of things were tried. Here's what I think happened. Now you're asking, why didn't this happen this time?
Yes.
Not just the Democrats, but progressives in general, I think, also drank the Kool-Aid on the economy. That in general, we thought, big picture economic issues are a waste of time. The world's too complicated. There's nothing we can do about it. The great moderation that's going on in the 80s and 90s and afterwards, this is stuff that's just going to go on forever. So we'll be concerned about our individual issues, gay and lesbian issues, women's issues, environment, whatever our issues were, poverty, et cetera, these were things that we could focus on, and we didn't have to care. I call it, we got in our silos, our issue silos. Mm-hmm. Progressives became involved in issue silos, and I think the Democrats became, as a result, more corporatist and also just reflected individual, a laundry list of issues. And everybody abdicated on the progressive side on broader economic issues. So when the crisis hit, there was nothing in our cupboard. We had no ideas. We hadn't been talking about it to ourselves or anybody else. So the Democrats just went on doing what they normally do, which is, look, there's a payoff if you play ball with Wall Street.
Yes.
There's a job there waiting for you. I don't know how long it's going to take for Chris Dodd to end up on Wall Street, but he will, and so will Larry Summers, and so will Tim Geithner. They'll all end up there sometime or another. These are the kind of people that make it run. Look, in the 1920s, Brandeis was writing letters to Felix Frankfurter, and they were both sort of saying, in the long run, we think probably workers need to run their own factories. That was in the 20s they're talking about this.
Wow.
There's nothing like that going on now. We don't have a dialogue going on amongst progressives and certainly not amongst Democrats. As a matter of fact, I think the Democratic Party is just about terminal. This would be a very good time to see an alternative to the Tea Party. I'd call it a jobs party, a formation within the Democratic Party that actually put job creation first and foremost, 24/7, that's all we're going to talk about. Nothing else. We're just going to talk about putting Americans back to work, doing something about their mortgage crisis, doing something about their economic
realities,
problems. Yeah, their reality.
Yeah.
And call it a jobs party. Let's see the Tea Party tackle that. The sad part is the Democrats are no longer a party of jobs. That, I thought they'd never get away from that, but they just aren't. They just gave up on that.
Well, there are members. There's two.
Oh, there's some. I'm
very few, though.
In general.
Barney Frank is in a position of leadership, and he's for many, many years, and he's been head of the banking committee, I believe it is, and he knows about this stuff, and he's one of. is a reliable progressive generally. He understands all this stuff, the hedge funds, as you say, for every dollar.
I've been watching him sort of carefully. I don't know him. I've never met him or worked with him. I don't know his staff. But what started to worry me was when he started using the term financial innovation. We don't want to stifle financial innovation. Anybody who says the word financial innovation is, that's, to me, the signal that there's a real problem. because I don't believe there is such a thing as financial innovation. You know, Paul Volcker, the former Fed chair, made this great comment that I've been re-quoting again and again. He says the only good financial innovation that took place in the last 30 years was the creation of the ATM. The rest of it has been, you know, new versions of three-card Monte. And the fact that Barney Frank felt compelled to protect financial innovation makes me worry. That shows you how far they're enveloped by the kind of mystique of Wall Street. Barney didn't want to push hard enough to say, hey, you know what? Emperor has no clothes here, guys.
Right.
You know, I don't think you're producing new vital products for the American public. You're producing new gambling games for yourself.
Wow. Not a pretty picture. We're speaking with Les Leopold, Executive Director of the Labor Institute and Public Health Institute in New York, author of The Looting of America, How Wall Street's Game of Fantasy Finance Destroyed Our Jobs, Pensions, and Prosperity, and What We Can Do About It. Well, in an ideal world, Les, what could we do about it? You talk about, and I think this is a fascinating idea and hasn't been talked about nearly enough, with regard to what is a public utility now? We have certainly the most basic and obvious are water and the regulation of some natural gas, things like that that people depend on, that are no longer just items for the few and wealthy. Everybody needs it. We depend on it. I think one could say that cable TV, cable information, data over the wires, I would think could be and should be considered a public utility, public and private combined. In your ideal world, what would be on the platform for how this world of finance, this socialized now world of finance that's getting treatment like nobody else, is a special system of socialism for them and only them, how could, if it were recognized as a regulated public utility, how would it work?
That's a great topic for debate and discussion. I think we have to do some serious work. But here are some basics. First of all, immediately, I would slap on a 50% windfall profits tax on every financial firm, every major financial firm. And the argument being, look, you know, we bailed you out. Now you're going to pay us back.
And what is a windfall? How would you define a windfall?
The windfall is because we bailed you out. That's the windfall. It stays on until unemployment comes down to 5%. That's the first thing I do. Second thing,
makes
I would
sense.
Slap on the financial transaction tax, because you got to reduce the pay in Wall Street when you reduce the amount of money flowing into Wall Street. So that's the second thing I do. The third thing I would do is to begin the process of turning those 19 largest too big to fail institutions into regulated public utilities, where the, you know, the shareholders, in a sense, would be bought out, and they would be no longer operating in an uncontrolled environment, an uncontrolled, you know, profit maximization environment. How exactly to do that, I don't know. But I'm not the first one, by the way, to have thought about this. Keynes also had tremendous concerns during the 1930s and 40s that capitalism wasn't going to work if you didn't, in a sense, nationalize the essential features of banking. And this guy named Hyman Minsky in the United States also was arguing this during the 50s and 60s. And I think we have to go revisit those plans. But that would be the last thing I would do. I think the windfall profits tax, by the way, according to a Bloomberg poll, is, you know, widely popular. And the financial transaction tax, which an average person who's buying and selling stocks, you know, normally would never even notice this thing, would really come down on that top fraction, you know, 0.1% of Americans is playing in the casino. Those two things would go a long way. But the key thing now would be to, while you're sitting on Wall Street and thinking about a longer-term plan, you got to use that money to put people back to work. The other thing a Jobs Party could do, as well as the free higher education, is to say, look, we're going to weatherize every home and business in the United States, coast to coast. And this isn't going to be done with the federal bureaucracy. We're going to make money available to state and local governments. You hire the contractors, but you get it done. Start at one end of the town, and you mow on through to the other end. And we'll, you know, help support training programs to make sure there's enough contractors that can do this. And we'll try to, you know, maintain some sort of overall quality control to make sure that, you know, money's not wasted and that the work is done well. That would be the, you know, government's job, but that could be also a state of function. And we would save money in the long run in terms of energy costs, and you would put, you know, a lot of people to work. The combination of the free higher ed and the weatherization program, just those two things would make an enormous dent in the unemployment figures, and I think it would give people that 1930 sense that this country was doing something.
Yes.
You know, this was a cool place to be. In the 30s, a lot of people felt a lot of pride in what was being built.
Yes.
Construction projects, the great conservation tree planting things, you know, something like a billion trees were planted in the South, South alone, to sort of bring, deal with soil erosion, all this kind of stuff. You know, this would be our modern equivalent. We're finally doing something about the energy crisis in terms of massive conservation, something that every home and business would experience, and we're educating our young. It would be a huge shot in the arm, and you could do it, you could gear up something like this within 90 days.
Oh,
it would be nothing to get it going.
Absolutely, and so much was created back then that we still use, the national park system, building. And Obama talked a little bit in his State of the Union speech about investing in energy. I haven't seen it, but it seems to me that that is where the money is for the future. If we had started a long time ago when we became aware of an energy crisis back in the early 1970s, think where we'd be. Well, we're not there, but at least we could put people to work now, harness our research and development, have some involvement in the economy. And, the idea that there is no government involvement in the economy, that we have a free market, it's not the case. It's not the case. There is, I think one could argue, you've made the case very clearly, that we do have socialism for a special sector of the economy, the finance industry, but that if we had actual government investment and saying, we have something called the common good, government has to be there for the common good. That was clearly the intention of the founders of this country. We could get involved in having the U.S. become a leader in energy development, alternative energy. We're losing big time to the Chinese and to lots of other people in terms of high-speed rail. Could create a lot of jobs and really, really help the economy and help the free market. Help the free market, because we are, the average business is behind the eight ball in so many ways. You can't compete against the socialism for Wall Street. So on that note, you have some degree of hope? Or are you just, I agree with you. I don't see the Democrats talking about it at all. Obama has made some.
I hate to say this. I think for a while, though, there's going to be more deterioration, unfortunately, because there's an imploding trade union movement. There's an enormous attack brewing now on public sector workers. There's a lot of confusion about, there's the memories of people who are being clouded now and about what really caused this. Wall Street's really protected itself quite well. So I think
then playing a huge bonus.
If we're lucky, there might be a downtick in the unemployment for a while. But I don't think we're going to get a great jobs growth thing for a while, and I don't think we're going to get serious financial reforms or serious jobs programs or anything like that because there's such hatred of the government. But what I'm hoping is that this time around we got the conversation going. And I think we're going to get another opportunity because I think the same instability is still deep within our economy and there's going to be another crash. And you know what? You don't know where it could come from. It could be, a country in Europe could all of a sudden have a debt crisis we didn't know about. It could be, some unusual event that takes place someplace in the globe, a nuclear plant going down. It could be anything. It's a very fragile system, and the same rod is still in the center of the financial system, so it could all come down again. What I'm hoping is that our financial literacy is increasing, and we're more confident about participating and talking about it and not just saying, let the free enterprise solve all these problems, which it clearly can't do, especially in the financial sector. So
we don't have really that system.
Unfortunately, I'm getting older, so I'm a little worried that I'm not going to see much of this in the future.
Right.
I'm sort of like both. I'm optimistic about being able to have the conversation. I'm pessimistic that anything is going to change in the short run, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't keep trying.
We have to keep trying. We have to keep trying. Les Leopold, thank you so much for being with us. His most recent book is The Looting of America, put out by Chelsea Green in 2009, and he's working on another about the rise of Wall Street billionaires and the one-sided class war. We'll stay with it. Thank you very much for being with us on the Bert Cohen Show.
Thank you.
Thank you. We got to keep with it. do email me, bert@bertcohen.com. Money. Yeah.
Yeah.